This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas. It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, chewing the fat with Rex and Paul, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio CALS, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org. Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio CALS. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to Primary Sources, a service of the Central Arkansas Library System. I am Matt DeCampbell, and our guest today is Sarah Wilkerson Freeman, who is a history professor at Arkansas State University in Jonesboro, and is also the curator of an exhibition right here at the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, where we record the show. And the exhibition is called The Art of Injustice and talks about the Japanese internment camps in Roar and Jerome, Arkansas during the 1940s, which some of our listeners may have a history of and some may not. And we'll delve into that in a minute. But first, hi, Professor Freeman.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Thank you for agreeing to do it. To start out, before we get into the exhibition itself, let's talk a little bit about you. What is your personal history in Arkansas?
Well, I've been at Arkansas State University now for over 20 years. So I'm a full professor in the history department. And my professional focus is on Southern history in particular. So I was trained at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And a lot of the work that I focus on is on social movements, to some degree, civil rights, human rights, politics. And so when I was approached about 5 years ago by the heirs of Paul and Ann Ferris about a cache of photographs that had been taken in Arkansas for decades, I was especially interested in the ones that I found that were taken in the Roar Japanese camp in July of 1945. So Paul Ferris took about 170 black and white photographs as really the camps were beginning to close down, as people were making plans. So it was an era of the incarceration of Japanese Americans that is also not widely understood. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we had two camps in Arkansas in the South, these were the only camps in the Jim Crow, racially segregated South. The fact that we had those camps really also challenged the structures of racism. And I think that the people who had some close experience with the people in these camps came out of it changed. So we see in the collection that the Butler Center has of Jamie Vogel's pieces that I think Rosalie Gould was very instrumental in making sure that this collection came to the Butler, that we have artifacts of work that was done, but also given to a much beloved art teacher. There were a number of art teachers in the camps. Many of them were Japanese or Japanese American, but also many other non-Japanese who worked in the camps. So that relationship, I think, opened the way for a broader social consciousness about racism, about the injustice of racial segregation, racial bigotry and prejudice, and so on. So I see this as an opening chapter of the civil rights movement in the history of Arkansas.
And those names that you spoke of off the top, there's the tie-in to how this all came together with Hendricks College.
Yes, and it's the circle of Hendricks faculty that are instrumental in the creation of this particular collection. This is not just a series of black and white photographs. As much as I love just black and white photographs, But these photographs tell a story. So through the research that my students and I have done, with the aid of Anne Ferris's manuscript and her research, Anne Ferris was the photographer's wife who came with him and interviewed people and kept incredible notes and kept up with people after the camps closed. All of that material points to a community at Hendricks that included Elsie and Lewis Friend, Floy Hansen, who was a Memphis artist who came on temporarily into the art department at Hendricks during the war, but also John Gould Fletcher, who was a very good friend of Elsie and Lewis Friend, as well as the Ferrises. So there's this small community, fairly tightly knit, that really began to realize that what was going on in terms of the incarceration of families, babies, the elderly, these were not criminals. Their only crime, if you will, was being 1/16th Japanese heritage or more. So to have those people incarcerated so closely to the college, it inspired Floy Hansen to grab Elsie Friend and get in a car and drive down to Jerome to visit people. And when they did that, and it looks like it's probably late 43 when they did that, they discovered Henry Sugimoto, who was an Oakland painter and who had begun painting what camp life was like, because at that point in the incarceration, few cameras were allowed, limited photography. So he began painting what it was like for his wife and daughter to be incarcerated with his wife and daughter behind barbed wire with, you know, guard towers and searchlights sweeping the camp at night, and the kind of fear that would, of course, instill in anybody. But if you have your family in a camp, I don't think we can even imagine what that's like. And the uncertainty of the war in general. They could not know what their future would be, you know, in 1943 or 1944, mm-hmm. 1945. So Floy and Elsie saw these paintings and were very moved by them. And Floy was also the curator of the gallery at Hendricks. And she arranged to bring Henry Sugimoto and his wife Susie and about 15 of his mural-sized paintings out of the camp, out of Jerome, and get them up to Hendricks College. And she did an exhibition, a public exhibition, in February 1944. And it really showed something of what it was like to be in that kind of situation that you might say was really so un-American. One of the paintings shows a soldier, a Japanese-American soldier in U.S. military uniform, leaving the camp, and his wife holding their baby and has with another son being held back by an MP saying, "Stop, you know, this is as far as you can go," as he goes off to fight, possibly die, as many in the 442nd did. Fight and die for the very country whose government was incarcerating his wife and babies. So the real irony, rather cruel irony, of that experience is what Henry Sugimoto depicted. And so that relationship between the Hendricks faculty, and Paul Ferris took a wonderful photographs of those paintings when they were at Hendricks, that relationship enabled Paul Ferris then to go down to Rohr in 1945 at the behest of Alan Eaton, who was working on a book on art in the incarceration camps in the United States. So Paul Ferris already had that relationship, and Henry Sugimoto had been moved from Jerome to Rohr, so Sugimoto was his guide. And he took, again, about 170 photographs, not just of the art and artists, but also of the children, of the interiors of the barracks, which I think are quite interesting, how people personalized these into as much like a home as you possibly could. And the culture, just what it was like in terms of the relationships, but also between the older people in the camps and the younger people in the camps, why there were still people in the camps so late into 1945, because the relocation system had been moving pretty quickly. So who is largely left are older folks, also Issei, who were Japanese nationals, not allowed to be citizens until the 1950s, and people who had kids or who had the kind of business that they really could not, you know, make a living unless there was a good group of Japanese Americans, you know, where they needed to go. So if you had a Japanese cuisine restaurant in Stockton, you need for there to be enough people to have returned for you to start your restaurant again. But we get a sense of the real dislocation and relocation because Henry Sugimoto did not go back to California. He instead goes to New York, and it was hard, very hard. But you see the real dramatic change it made in people's lives. And his daughter still lives in that apartment in New York, Madeline Sugimoto, who's been tremendously helpful to me with research. So also in the photographs are people who obviously are still alive, the people who are children. So we're able to, with the kinds of archives that we have now, the digital archives, through vital statistics, Facebook, other kinds of social media, we are able to find people who were children in these photographs and know what became of them, which is, I think, one of the last chapters that we really need to know is it wasn't just a system of victimization. People did come through it, but it was unconscionable. It was something that Ronald Reagan apologized for. Reparations were paid in the 1990s. So the United States did come through and recognize this incredible injustice. And it's something that we should not ever forget. And that's really, I think, a lot of the message that we hope people will come away with.
So let's step back to a little bit of a bigger picture historically for people that may not know the full story of these camps. The U.S. enters the war in December of 1941. And then how do we get from there to having two internment camps in South Arkansas in these tiny little communities?
Well, they were very isolated, as they continued to be, quite frankly. Executive Order 9066 was signed by Franklin Roosevelt in February of 1942. And what this did was to give a great deal of authority to military leaders in particular districts to decide who could and could not be in those districts. So Executive Order 9066 didn't say specifically, force all Japanese Americans off the West Coast. But that was the way it was executed by the military leaders. And we now know that they were not entirely honest about what they tried to say was the danger of having a population of Japanese Americans on the West Coast. But in any case, that was what was executed, was the forced removal of 120,000 people from their homes from Oregon to Washington, Oregon, California. And it went along fairly swiftly. By March, large segments of the population are being removed to Manzanar and also to the assembly centers. So it was a staged process in which you would see posted up in your community a notice saying that you and your family must come to such and such place to be taken to, say, the Santa Anita racetrack, where you would live in horse stalls for about 6 months while the camps were being built. And there were 10 camps. And two of them were in, again, this very isolated region of Arkansas, because that was really the point, to isolate this population. Now, our own governor was very insistent. There was resistance to this in Arkansas. But as long as it was clear that this colony, if you will, of Japanese Americans could not remain after the war, then Arkansas went along with having these two camps. And they took them out of kind of sunken lands. These were not prime pieces of real estate.
Sure.
These were snake-infested, mosquito-infested swampland. And that was where a population largely from the Stockton area, mostly from California, Northern California, were brought to these camps, and Jerome and Rohr, and they were about 30 miles away from each other. So this was a high concentration of Japanese Americans. But as I said, this was in the racially segregated South. So interesting challenges in regards to that situation.
Do we know much about why the military, like you said, these were the only ones in the South, why they chose that part of Arkansas and that part of the South?
Well, the state government had to go along with it.
Right.
And there was pushback.
Yeah.
They were sunken lands that some had been back taxes were involved. So there were properties, generally the properties that the federal government used, mm-hmm. were properties like in the Sonora Desert that right. were part of an Indian reservation, or, you know, very arid land, Heart Mountain, areas outside of, you know, Phoenix, you know, Poston, that are just not, they're not prime land, and it's land that the government can control. So at least with these properties, again, in Arkansas, it was land that the government could control. It is interesting that they were obviously west of the Mississippi, but not very far west of the Mississippi.
Barely.
And there had been some discussion about shifting the population to the East Coast. Well, of course, the military officials on the East Coast didn't want a sudden flood of 120,000 Japanese Americans, who apparently military leaders in the West Coast were so concerned about. So it left this sort of middle swath, if mm-hmm. you will, that was a fair game for relocation. Also, it's important to note that Chicago, as a result of its location being obviously in the middle of the country and not having a very large Japanese American population, hardly any, a War Relocation Authority headquarters was set up in Chicago, and so we ended up with something of a pipeline from the Arkansas camps to Chicago. So there were just areas where the government decided there was not a great concern about having this concentration of Japanese Americans.
Because you had low population, low risk, low whatever military equations were
calculated. Is anybody going to go to... Yeah. And indeed, there are some sort of cute stories about young people finding ways to get under the barbed wire and go running around the swamps. So one young woman told a story on the Densho website, which is really important for your listeners to know about. That's D-E-N-S-H-O. And if you go into that site, you can see a number of video interviews. And some of the people who were interviewed are also in these photographs. So one young lady decided to just escape, just see what was out there. She was probably about 10 or 12 when she did this and found a little gap in the barbed wire. It was daytime when she did it. And she went down. She found what was out there was a dusty, long country road. Mm-hmm. And she walked and walked. And then she found this little store. And she went in, and it was operated by African Americans in the countryside of Arkansas. And they looked at her rather strangely. Here's this little Japanese girl comes wandering in, but they were very nice to her, mm-hmm. and I think gave her some, you know, ice cream or something. And she remembered that the rest of her life, as that was what really impressed her in terms of, for one, how isolated, but also the difference between where she had come from in California and where she suddenly was in the really wilds of Arkansas.
And two, it's just an interesting experience, it sounds like, because that kind of cross-cultural encounter where both sides have almost no context for the other, and it just comes down to human interaction, and that it's a little girl wandering into your country store.
Obviously a very powerful, you know, moment for her, and probably mm-hmm. for her hosts as well. But Madeline Sugimoto told me about, she remembered going into McGee. And when Japanese Americans would go into town to shop or whatever, they usually had somebody from the camp who would go with them, somebody within administration,
yeah.
and a minder, if you will. And so this woman went with Susie Sugimoto and her little daughter, Madeline, and Madeline needed to go to the bathroom. And so in her, you know, six-year-old mind, she knew that she was in a camp, that she'd been forced out of California, she and her parents, because they weren't white. Mm-hmm. She knew that. So she's looking at the bathrooms, and one says colored and one says white. And she says, well, I know I'm not white. So she started to use the colored bathroom. And the woman from the camp grabbed her and said, no, 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 and steered her towards the white bathroom, which completely confused her. But you could see how having a third racial group really did challenge that idea of our sort of biracial segregated system of the Jim Crow South.
And you talk about the children and Madeline as a good example. And, of course, the most well-known resident in the Arkansas internment camps is George Takei, the actor. And I've heard his stories and been lucky enough to talk with him before. And he obviously went through a very rough time as a small child that made him, gave him a lot of resolve and strength in his adult years. And of course, he's now revisited constantly and taken his story to Broadway and all these things. Have you found with the families that you've interacted with, the children, is there a mix between those that kind of had their spirits crushed and those that blossomed after their time in the internment camp? Or did a lot of them gain more resolve from that time and was able to use that unfortunate part of their early life to guide them better in their adult life?
Well, there's no one answer to
that.
Because really what mattered a great deal is the impact on the parents. So for example, with Alice Nishida, who was born originally in Maricopa, Arizona in 1934, when she's a baby, whites in the area began to organize to firebomb the houses of the Japanese Americans, this colony of farmers in Arizona.